The Science of Safety Online, brought to you by the Online Safety Exchange. I'm Martin Cocker, and this is Radio SOSA.
Matt Toth, you are here on the OSX podcast, Radio SOSA, the Science of Safety Online. And here because, you know, I've known you for nearly 10 years. You've worked for almost every sector, as far as I, as far as I'm aware, for civil society, private sector, and then starting out in the government sector as a teacher. I just want to throw you straight in the deep end a little bit with a hypothetical. Say that tomorrow you get appointed to a job. You're the head of trust and safety of a you know, new fast growing social network, and it's, you know, user generated content, usual kind of social media thing. I'm not sure what's making this one so popular, but it is. And you've been appointed to head of trust and safety, and you say to the founders, okay, what have we got in place? And they say, you. Where do you start? What is the first thing going through your mind as you take that role on?
Yeah, it sounds a lot like social media 10 years ago, right? It's just the, hey, we need someone to do this. Why don't you go figure it out? The benefit we have now is, you know, with a good 10, 15 years, right? It, more depending upon the types of platforms you're looking at, of knowledge in terms of how to think about this, right? There are risk assessment frameworks, safety by design principles. There's a lot of, you know, basic tooling that could easily be put in place in order to ensure user safety, right? And a lot of that has to do with, one is, what is the data telling us, right? Types of interactions, behaviors, things like that. What are we seeing already? Two, I mean, everything from simple as, you know, user reports, low-level automatic detection, I think depending upon the size of the platform, right, will determine how much you want to invest in tools, whether you're going to utilize, you know, AI proactive detection or, you know, simple keyword stuff, which I feel like we've kind of graduated beyond those days as far as the tech goes, right? And then three is, what are our policies? What are we enforcing? Where does our app operate? What are the norms of the community? I love the consistent conversation of, where is that balance between regulation, due diligence, freedom of expression, in order to support user autonomy. And at the end is, once we look at all those data, those policies, those procedures, everything that's in place, do we have a healthy community, right? Because all communities are going to have some type of friction in it, right? It's the nature of human interaction as we speak and connect and have conversations. And, you know, I don't think we have that platform yet that allows for difficult conversations to happen yet. Humans have done a good job of making our topics polarizing. So trying to have that healthy community in place and having tools and resources and policies and other stuff in place to support that, I think that's kind of where you start from, and then you get your baseline.
Yeah, I don't know. I hope Elon Musk doesn't listen to that, because he's pretty sure he's cracked it. So,
right? He's had the answers for a long time.
Yeah, we shall see. What, just want to sort of know a little bit about your history coming into where you know you are today. So you were Spectrum Labs, and I understand Spectrum Labs as a organization that builds technology for safety. So if I was starting a social media company tomorrow, or a, you know, gaming platform tomorrow, mm-hmm. I could go to you and I could take product that you are producing and I plug it into my system, and it you know, provides me with safety functionality. That's how I understand it. Is that oversimplifying? It's guaranteed it's oversimplifying, but is it oversimplifying too much?
No, I mean, that's essentially it, right? If you're looking for a text-based solution to detect harmful behavior on your platform, or even healthy behaviors, yeah, we're one of the companies you can come to help with that.
Like, when I first met you, I think you had come out of teaching, and mm-hmm. you were with the I Can Help project, mm-hmm. and it was, I think, a trial of a helpline in the mm-hmm. US. And is that actually where you entered into online safety? I mean, did you have experiences in teaching that you would consider to have been foundational online safety experiences, or did you transition into it with that move?
Yeah, I mean, that was definitely the two worlds kind of converging, right? So within education, this is going way back, but as a teacher, mobile phones were very pervasive, right? Like, I can remember kids texting in class as far when SMS really kind of exploded in the early 2000s. And, you know, kids would have their phones and they'd be hiding them in their desk, or they'd have to look for a pencil 15 times during class. Or, you know, my favorite was when they would like take their phone and like slide it under their butt in their chair. And then I'd kind of tease them. I'm like, you know, that phone's going to be next to your face in like an hour, right? And so there, you know, we'd have those kind of moments as a teacher to figure out, like, how do I manage this? Because teenagers, in particular, and humans are very social. Teenagers are ridiculously social. And so that currency, that connection, that constant communication is a very exciting thing for a young person. And so I had to learn very early on how to manage a classroom around these devices, and how do I get kids focused on learning, you know, amidst all the distraction. You know, fast forward in just a very short amount of time, not even 5 years, you have smartphones, which now enabled access to social media in classrooms. So social media was already kind of a thing. This is sort of the end of MySpace and the beginning of Facebook and the emergence of Instagram and others. And within that, a lot of the issues we'd see at school, at that time I was helping out as administrator, I was a tech trainer, I was still teaching full-time, working at another nonprofit called the California Association of Directors of Activities, and I was doing a lot of their technology support with educators. And how do you use tech in the classroom to teach kids, and how can we show them to do something positive? There was a massive assumption that young people just knew tech better. And what we found is young people knew how to use tech that made their lives easier, more important, or socially connected, right? And anything beyond that, it's that it needed to be shown or taught in some ways, because it's that you need someone to kind of, you know, to model the behavior. And that didn't exist yet. And so in that time, what we saw, particularly middle school, and definitely, so that's around age 13, you know, 12 up to 14, and then from 15 to 18 year olds, it was just, for, as the kids would put it, drama. Right? It'd be taking a picture and cropping someone out. It'd be taking a photo and then tagging the friend who wasn't there to show you're hanging out. It might be sharing photos of someone you took without permission. There's kind of ran the gamut of problems that were occurring. And so without good reporting tools on platforms yet, you were lucky to have user reporting. And even then, it probably went to an email queue that was 20, 30,000 emails deep per day. And so trying to navigate that and help young people sort of manage the other side of it, because on our end as a teacher, you're seeing fights at school, friendships ending, grades are dropping, just creating a lot of problems. That's about the time we had some social media incidents. In this case, it was a couple threats against students telling them to go kill themselves. And that's what kind of where I Can Help came out of, is how can we train students to respond to this? How can we teach them to report? How can we teach them to use, you know, positive comments in order to support the victim and politely let the person who's causing the problem know that it's not okay, right? Because if, you know, if you've ever been a parent or anything else, if someone calls you stupid and you call them stupid back, you've just escalated the fight. You haven't de-escalated it. So how can we teach young people how to respond in those situations? And then those two worlds kind of converged. I was doing a presentation. Some folks from the Google policy team were there, happened to catch it, and they got excited. That's where I met the amazing Ann Collier, and that's where the idea for the helpline came up, right? I know we had in New Zealand, Australia, UK, there were a lot of helplines in different regions of the world at that point, and the US did not have one. And so that was my first experience of working with platforms and kind of bridging the gap between schools, everyday folks, trying to add additional context to these social media incidents as they're happening in order to find a solution for stuff that needed to get taken down, things that potentially might need to be escalated to law enforcement, to even helping schools sort of manage and how they can navigate and investigate these situations on their own and hopefully de-escalate them themselves.
Yeah, I think that role of helplines is quite misunderstood, that sort of brokering thing. I think people, especially because the helpline typically doesn't have any special powers, so people assume that there's nothing the helpline can do that they can't do themselves, or that someone else can't do themselves. But of course, what happens when you work on a helpline is, you know, I know from my experience and you know from yours, is that you become deeply expert in those systems. You become deeply expert in how everything works, and it takes you moments to do stuff, something that would take people days doing their own research and placing reports. And as a result, the helplines have this, you know, huge success rate versus what the average consumer does. So you trialed that helpline for a year and a half, I think, thereabouts, and it came to an end. You know, pilot ended. I know that there's still a page up that sort of outlines the kind of learnings from it. But can you talk about your experience, the highlights, lowlights of that for you, and
So, yeah, if you go to socialmediahelpline.net, that page still exists, and there's all the case study, the data, the stuff connected to that. I was very, very grateful to work with Ann Collier on that piece. She definitely brought the industry expertise, which I was still emerging from, and, you know, I was there for the school part of it. Things that became clear very early on is, one is, many schools were vastly underprepared. There wasn't a lot of understanding of how social media worked. There was not a lot of understanding of how young people were relating to social media and the value it held within their lives in terms of identity, connection, and friendships. Yeah. So for many adults, if a young person came to them, say a teacher, administrator, and said, hey, I'm having this problem on, you know, pick a platform, if the adult didn't take them seriously or didn't investigate in a way that the young person felt validated their experience, then kids would just stop telling people, right? One was, schools that had good relationships, were good at building culture with their students, were more likely to have students who would come forward when something inappropriate was happening online, or would have students who would speak up online in support of whatever individual was being harassed, bullied, you know, pick something. It was not always the good kids that spoke up per se, but it was the kids who felt empowered or had some type of like leadership quality where other students at the school looked up to them. And that could have been an athlete, a bigger kid on campus. It's that kind of ran the gamut. And we've seen that a lot of my background's in student leadership development, student leadership training. And, you know, at any given school, there's a lot of kids who have leadership qualities, but don't fit in the mold of what everyone would call great students, right? They don't have a 4.0 GPA. They're not studying 15 hours a night and holding down three jobs and playing five sports. Like, they're just kids who happen to have a lot of social capital and other students at the school look up to them. Those kids were hugely influential in changing what happened both online and offline. Another one was just trying to help schools see the value of social media. At this time, early 2010s, still seems weird to say that, there was a lack of appreciation for the value that social media brought, right? You know, privacy law was new. It was definitely not a course that was taught to school admin at schools or teachers. So what to share, when to share it, who to share it about, how to, you know, build social media teams. You had brands at this time were taking off when it came to marketing, but schools were not. And so the idea of modeling and, you know, certain behavior and how do you celebrate, you know, your whole entire community in one space, like, no one really knew that. It was still very reactive and, you know, it's only bad stuff. So we're just going to block it. We're going to ban it. We're going to prevent people from using this. With the helpline itself, you know, just the relationship, we'd have a lot of schools call in and they'd be very concerned over like, what can we tell you? What can we not tell you? And they're really just at this nexus point. So trying to get the word out and understand how the helpline could work with them. Once we had that relationship, it was streamlined pretty good. But schools in general, because that's who we worked with rather than individuals, right? Because we, by having a school official in place, it kind of created an extra layer in terms of when you think about context and investigation, you want a credible layer, right? Usually get a parent. That parent is invariably biased towards their child. So yeah. I wanted to be cautious of that. But within that scope, if we get a report in, is then it became sort of a learning curve in terms of how to escalate to the platforms and what needs to be brought to attention and triaging, which is very similar to what moderation teams are doing on a platform on any given day right now. So learning, you know, from that experience, trying to explain to educators that, like, just because you called it doesn't mean like this is going to be resolved in like the next 20 minutes. Like, there's a time, there's a process, there's reporting tools, and we got to message people and creating those systems in place. And so trying to mitigate those expectations or manage those expectations and then figure out what were the things that really needed our attention now. That definitely took a little bit of time, but it worked. So it was nice to have the individual there because there were a lot of cases, whether it was sextortion, you know, misunderstanding around sharing an image. It could have to do with stuff in platform about kids just being harassed and the post not being taken down. But with the additional context we could provide to the platform and the issue could be resolved. It might take a couple of days, but at least it got handled appropriately. So that it was kind of nice to be able to have a direct line to the platforms at the time and be able to have those conversations.
Yeah, I think there's a value that people lose sight of, but just the fact that the helpline exists and that somebody's mm-hmm. prepared to invest in it builds confidence that we're not just letting the online world run amok. We're actually, you know, we're actually having a go. Mm-hmm. Having run a helpline that had a pretty high success rate in helping people, I often found that people were just pleased to have someone to talk to mm-hmm. And to sort of advocate on their behalf, And that made them feel as though that, you know, they weren't alone, they weren't abandoned to this kind of experience, and it makes a huge difference. But over the years, I've been approached quite a few times by people out of the US, and they, you know, they've said, well, we love this idea of a helpline. We love this New Zealand approach. You know, they're probably doing the Oceania tour, dropping in Australia, coming to New Zealand, having a look. And, you know, they go and they say, yeah, we'd love to set up a helpline for the US. Well, there, I mean, there is no national equivalent of NetSafe or eSafety in the US. Do you think there ever will be? Do you think the US is a market where that can work?
Yeah, I actually had that conversation with someone earlier today. It would be a good idea. I think there would be something that needs to happen. We have the FTC and others looking at it. This is why I'm very curious to see how these programs evolve in various countries, right? So whether it's the, you know, the media hubs that tend to look at like news orgs and others are just like, well, online's media, so of course it'll fall under here. So that's where you get like the FTC and others in the US. But it'd be nice to have a body if that was their purview, just because it would give it some focus, right? Once you have an issue owner, then you have someone who can drive it and focus on it and work on building up those relationships and, you know, identifying what needs to happen versus kind of, you know, whatever project or trend or high concern exists at any one given time, right? So having some kind of body like that, I think, would make a difference. Will it happen? I have no idea. That's always the joy of government, and why I'm choosing to stay away at this point is it gets very hard to try and allocate funds and get consensus behind something without having to be politicized.
Yeah, well, but there's clearly a lot of interest in online safety in the US at the moment. I read there was 144 state level bills in progress, you know, generally online safety bills. You've got at least three significant federal ones that I can think of.
And that's the challenge, right? Is with 50 states, if you pass 50 laws, to have any one platform to comply with those 50 laws, my dream, again, like dream scenarios, it would be great if the US had a federal privacy law. It'd be great if the US had a federal code around whether it's transparency reports or other stuff, similar to like what we've seen with the DSA or the online safety bill or what, you know, the eSafety Commissioner's Office has done or others, just because it would simplify things, right? It would give some coherency and consistency to it. The need is there, but yeah, trying to get something passed has been the bigger challenge.
Just pivoting back slightly, you talked about student leadership and social capital. You know, one of the things that you do is you work with the All Rise Foundation. So we talk about people with social capital. There's Aaron Judge, who around the world people might need explaining who he is, but certainly in America, I think most people would know who he is. Aaron Judge is a baseball player for the New York Yankees, and that is understating what he is, I guess, in terms of his presence in baseball. What is, just in general terms, what is All Rise about?
Yeah, so the Aaron Judge All Rise Foundation is all about helping young people see their potential. So Aaron, if you're a baseball fan, you will know who he is. He set the American League home run record last year. He's one of the most recognized faces in baseball, was the MVP, captain of the Yankees, which is a big deal. Again, for baseball fans, if you're not a Yankees fan, you're probably just like, he's a good player, but we don't like him. And if you're not a baseball fan at all, that's okay. He's still a nice guy. So about Aaron, I mean, he was a three-sport athlete. He's involved in student leadership. Both of his parents were educators, which is actually how I got involved in leadership, was through his mom. She's the one who kind of pulled me in. And we were in the same school district and said, hey, you should come do this thing. And so we've known each other for a bit. So when it came time for Aaron to launch his foundation and got approached, it made sense, because the mission was all about how do we reach out to young people, all young people, and help them understand their potential, right? You know, be good citizens, leadership skills, get back to the community, support programs, you know, take care, you know, give back at your school, whatever it is. And so from there, we do mini grants, which go towards youth programs that help develop these skills. So in the US, we have stuff like Boys and Girls Club. There's reading programs, dealing with supporting kids with autism, sports. We have a rowing program here. It was one of the mini grant recipients a couple years ago. And so anything we can do to kind of help young people hit this these places, we also do online masterclasses. So we'll interview individuals who are making a difference online, experts in online safety. We have folks who are, you know, leadership in the boardroom. So interview folks who are executives who've had successful careers and about what, how they define leadership, who are their mentors, you know, what are things that they value, as well as young people. And then a couple times a year, I get to interview Aaron and like, what does leadership in the clubhouse look like? And how do you work with other athletes? And how do you goal setting and basic things that I think many of us take for granted, but for a young person coming up and you think you can just walk out the door and be great at something, it's kind of partial truth, right? And we all know it takes effort and setting goals. And so how can we create systems to help train people around that?
Yeah, that sounds awesome. I mean, it does mean that from time to time, I see that you wear a Yankees hat and get photographed on social media, but I understand you're not actually, I mean, obviously you're not anti the Yankees because Aaron's there, but you're actually an Oakland Athletics fan. Is that right?
I am. I grew up on the A's. If baseball fan again in the 70s, they were the dominant team in the area. So I grew up on those legends. And then by the 80s, the A's were winning again, mid to late 80s, early 90s. And was always an A's fan, was a San Francisco Giants fan in there as well. That was a good time for them. And just a huge baseball fan. I've been to over 20 ballparks. So yeah. I got about 10 more to go and I'll hit them all. But yeah, no, love the A's, love going to baseball. It's just, it's a very intentional activity to go sit in a park and watch about 18 humans play a sport, and just hang out for a couple hours, talk to your friends and just enjoy the sun.
Which of the ballparks is your favorite?
That's a tough one. I, my historical purposes, I love Fenway. It's been around the longest, in Boston. Yeah. Yeah, every park has kind of its own unique experience. It has unique food, just an energy. Like when you walk in, I really enjoyed going to the Texas Rangers. That one was a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to it. I'd love to go to the St. Louis game. That one's on my list. So we'll kind of see.
Yeah. Back on track. What just recently, the Surgeon General released an advisory about social media and youth. Mm-hmm. I assume, given your line of work, you've had a chance to read through that, at least skim through it. There seems to be this growing theory that there's a direct, you know, correlational link between the growth of social media and the growth of mental health challenges for young people, and, you know, a sort of a general decline in the quality of life for young people with a growth in social media. I mean, what do you make of that theory or that idea that that's, those two things are linked?
Yeah, I have a few theories on that. One, I've been around long enough to know that there's never usually any one thing that causes something else, right? Like A does not always cause B. It's usually several other variables. Digital Wellness Lab out of Boston Children's Hospital and other groups have spoken up about this. The mental health increase in youth has been climbing since long before social media entered the scene, right? And so we've seen kind of the steady increase in mental health issues over the last 30 years, if not longer. What I do think tech is good at is identifying what it is that we want, even if we don't know it ourselves, right? It is hard to go anywhere and not talk to someone and be like, I was just talking about shorts. Now I'm getting ads on Facebook for shorts. And like, you can argue all day long if your phone's listening to you, but there's these sort of non-conscious things we do, whether it could be a Google search, it could be the way we type in a word. There's a lot of the data stuff happening on the back end that kind of tips our hand in terms of things we want, what we look for, and then the system finds it and says, hey, we think you want this. And so what I think tech is good is identifying what it is, what we want and what we need. And if we're coming to an online space and we're in a negative space in our head, or we're dealing with some mental health issues and we're seeking out that content, the system can help us find that much more easily, because that's sort of what the algorithm's trained to do, right? So in terms of connecting folks, I think there's some data to show that it could make situations worse, or give access to content that would not necessarily be healthy. And that's where I think platforms have some responsibility. But then two, I think to expressly lay the blame on tech, I do not think is entirely fair. I think there's a lot of other factors that influence sort of our health, our sense of well-being, and connection to society. And there's a lot of, I'd love to see more research to kind of show what are some, you know, things that have changed or shifted, or, you know, lifestyle, whatever, to kind of see what is kind of influencing all this.
I think one of the issues that people forget is that the tech age, the last 25 years, the most significant thing it's done is just peel the veneer off society in terms of showing us everything, things that we just weren't conscious of before. It's harder to hide from them. I do wonder if the role that tech has played is not so much in generating those negatives, but in really exposing them to young people. And I think when you see those things, that does weigh on you. I mean, it does have an effect. And so I think, you know, there may be an indirect causal link. That's probably the wrong way to describe it. Whereas the problem for me, of course, is that it's with this issue, as it is with disinformation a little bit at the moment, a belief that the problem exists because of social media, and therefore it's social media's problem to fix. You know, I don't personally buy into that. I'm not someone who believes entirely in a hands-off approach from tech either. I don't think they can just avoid their role. They're just too significant a player in modern society to do that. Speaking of avoiding their roles, just another hypothetical. I'm about to make you a judge of the Supreme Court of the United States. Congratulations. And if I was president, I would let you know. Yeah, I would jump at the chance to put you on the Supreme Court. But so you're on the Supreme Court, and you know, this case comes through, not, you know, similar to the two that have just gone through that involve Twitter and Google. Let's just say that you decide it does crest the threshold where you've got to consider the liability shield of Section 230. What do you make of the liability shield when you look at it? So over to you, Supreme Court Judge. You've got this position. We're asking you to review it. Do you just leave it in place? Do you want to move it? Do you want to adjust it? And if so, how?
Wow, that's a tough one. I'm not a judge, but I once played one at a holiday theme party where there was a murder mystery.
Excellent.
I do not think the internet as we know it would exist without Section 230. Within that scope, if we start going after platforms as having direct harm, I think the fallout could be just platforms just not operating, right? Because anyone can go into a platform and could post whatever, assuming that there are no tools in place, which is where a lot of the early day of the issues were, right? It's going way back. If you want to do some research on apps like FormSpring and others, where it was just like, kind of post whatever and let's see what we can do. Going forward, I don't know if I can see Section 230 going away. What I would like to see, and I do think can happen, is just platforms trying to do better. The issue with safety, when you think about, not even the most egregious, but let's think about, you know, hate speech and harassment and things like that. One is, I think governments have a strong responsibility to identify, more so than platforms, what is hate speech. Right, I think governments should be defining that. Platforms are not the arbiters of this is what's good or bad. And what's happening now is platforms are being put in a position to make value statements over what they think is or does not qualify in those categories. And without a clear definition, which should come from the government, not from any major platform, let's say hate speech specifically. So that's one. So if that's the case, if someone comes in and is saying that, you know, platforms have a responsibility to, like, what is our policy when this happens? What are we going to do when we see it happening? And how are we going to enforce it? I think that's a platform responsibility. If there's a crime or anything associated with that, I think it needs to fall to government. So having that collaboration between platforms and governments, I think, is huge. And that has not existed very strongly as of yet. I think there are systems in place, but I don't think that sort of collaboration of what it is or what that looks like. I mean, going back to Section 230, I think if it goes away, I think it's a slam on platforms. I do think there's responsibility. The biggest challenge with online safety is that it's a constant moving target. Like, it's never going to be 100%. And as you think about, you know, if I'm going to create a space for something to exist and people to have certain types of interactions, there's absolutely a duty of care there. But then where does that line sort of fall from duty of care to common sense to people just being outright terrible to each other because they can? And then what are the consequences for those actions?
Yeah. I mean, I'm really not a legal policy person. And whenever I talk legal policy stuff, I can just hear people, you know, shouting in their, headphones on the train. Yeah. They say, oh my goodness, here he goes again. Just totally lost it. I just, I really feel that the difficulty that we've had with a lot of attempts to legislate modern tech is that we've just continued to try to put modern technology into one of those kind of traditional pre-technology boxes. And I really feel with Section 230, it's that binary nature of it. You know, you're either a publisher or you're not. And we've developed, technology has developed business models based on a kind of a hybrid. You know, you are a bit of publisher, but you're not a publisher. And so as soon as you have to make them one or the other, you know, that those two binary choices have these negative consequences. If you make social media a publisher, all the liability issues will just destroy the business model. But if you leave them completely exempt from any liability, some, not all, but some will then, you know, use that as a shield from doing the right thing. So I feel like that, you know, there has to be a middle ground, but I just feel like we keep trying to push people, you know, into these old boxes, and that's where the problem lies. But like I say, not a policy legal person, and
same. Well, that's the challenge, yeah. Right? Is there's so much nuance to it, is in shades of gray, that it's trying to find that balance, and a lot of the conversations are, it's either one or the other.
Yeah.
Right. And like, it's never that, oh, like, we need to find this common ground in here. It's just like, no, we're either going to do this or this. It's like, and either one is going to have severe negative consequences.
Just picking up on the kind of youth online, young people online issues. One of the things that was floated a few years ago was, Meta at the time considering an Instagram for young kids, you know, a version of Instagram for young kids. And I'm not sure exactly where that's at, but it got parked and potentially put on the never, never. When that came out, did you see it as a potentially positive thing or an entirely negative or somewhere in between?
Kind of somewhere in between, right? Because we know just from a youth development standpoint, like with my kids, they did not have social media, but, you know, I would often have them use my social media with me. I'm not sharing content or stuff, but I would have conversations about what photos I liked and why I liked them and what videos I was watching and why I would watch those videos, or, you know, can we try and share YouTube videos together just to get a feel for, you know, I can kind of show them how the stuff worked and show them what I'm consuming and why I'm consuming it, that kind of thing. From a developmental standpoint, anytime I think we can sort of model and encourage, it's akin to growing up and watching shows with my parents on TV, right? Or, you know, playing catch with my dad. It'd be opportunities to talk, to share some content and just have some time together. To that point, I think there's a successful developmental piece. When Instagram Kids was coming out, multiple things were happening, right? So we saw the youth and tech and mental health was prominent in the news media cycle. I do not think there was a lot of trust in Meta or Instagram as a brand at that point, which, you know, the good faith of like, oh, we're doing this, you know, because we want to empower young people was not the message that was resonating. And then in the end, it kind of fizzled out because it's, if you don't have people who are going to use it, there's a lot of questions about privacy. Do we want young kids sharing photos on these platforms? I think that regulation has been pretty consistent, you know, since COPPA and GDPR and others for a while. It kind of didn't make sense.
Yeah. Not that you asked me, but my personal view on it was that...
Martin, what do you think, Martin? I'm kind of curious.
Thanks for the question. I like the idea of products specifically for the younger audience, because as a community, we can hold those companies accountable for safety expectations appropriate for that audience. So at the moment, we know there are kids of 9, 10, 11 years old on Instagram, and we're saying to Instagram, you've got to do something about those kids. And their answer is, this product is not for them. It shouldn't be here. But if they're building that product for 9, 10, 11-year-olds, they wouldn't be able to say that, and we'd be able to get into those conversations about whether they're doing a good enough job around safety.
And that could be one of the social developmental things, right? So, I mean, as a teacher, it's if I have middle school kids, so 12 and 13, they're looking up to 15, 16-year-olds. If I have 15-year-olds, they're emulating the 18-year-olds. And so even, you know, like TikTok had a young user setting that came out post COPPA settlement and others, of terms of if you put your ages under 13, you had a very specific app experience. And that was one of the arguments Instagram made, right, that you just alluded to, was, oh, well, if we have these individuals who are not 13 yet, then they can have this sort of, you know, secure experience similar to YouTube Kids and others. And Novel, that was great. You know, to that point, I'm more intrigued with the conversation of then how do you age gate? How do you age verify individuals so that when I am online, like, this is exactly who I am. And you know, you have markers in place to ensure that that person is being truthful about it, right? I don't know if you've ever done any research or come across that stuff. Policy-wise, it's incredibly complicated. I think that was kind of one of the intents behind it. I just don't know if that was the best intent.
I mean, that does sort of link to one of the kind of great problems of the internet safety since in all the time that I've worked in it, and that is age verification and having any kind of genuine way of knowing the age of a user. It feels as though the technology, I mean, it's a lot closer. We're almost at that point where we can start to lean into technology to verify ages. I know that there's, you know, lots of flaws in terms of how effective it is, but it does feel like we're getting relatively close. And it does, I mean, if we had, you know, accurate age verification systems, I mean, it would fundamentally change the online safety landscape, wouldn't it?
Very much so, in a heartbeat.
Oh, well, we'll have that conversation again in 5 years and see if that technology is in place.
Right.
As a company, Spectrum is heavy users of AI or developing AI for positive purposes to moderate content and manage safety challenges. So you're watching the debate around AI very closely, no doubt. You've seen at least two groups of eminent experts say, put AI back in a box and lock the box, you know. What do you make of the AI debate? Would you sign one of those 6 month pauses on its development requests that was put in front of you, or do you have a different idea?
I definitely wouldn't sign it. You know, it's kind of the genie's out of the bottle, right? When it comes to AI, like there are several things that you want to look forward to see and how something's going to be. It takes an incredible amount of media literacy knowledge, which I think, you know, some people have really well, others kind of take for granted. Many others are just like, I have no idea what media literacy is. What I have seen around any of the AI that's out is none of it exists or can work without some type of human verification, right? So for example, I mean, I can go into Bard, I can go to OpenAI and the others and say, hey, write me a 5-day itinerary to drive across the US. And it'll give me some good suggestions, variables in those suggestions, but I'm the one who still has to go through and verify that, right? Like one of them, I did it as a test and something came up for some kind of theme park attraction that was actually been closed for like 2 years, right? But like, yeah. I had to verify that. Otherwise, we could have just driven up and, you know, had an empty lot somewhere. So none of it has really been functioning without a human. Two is just data. Right. So a lot of like with that Spectrum, like our stuff is built on this massive data vault, right? This large anonymized data set that allows us to proactively detect very specific behaviors, both positive and negative. And within that, like that, you know, we have systems and procedures in place, you know, developed by, we have a couple academics on our staff who sort of develop these kind of checks and balances to make sure that that data is labeled accurately and to, as much as possible, eliminate bias. And then looking at how we continue to train and grow that data set to allow for various behaviors, which is something that long-term AI can do if it has a pretty large data set to pull from and look at, right? Because humans are crafty. We shift and change up and you know, we find something's not working, we try something else. It's just in our nature. So within AI, it's out there, it's happening. The last piece to that is just adoption, right? Like any great tech seems to take about 5 or 10 years before it becomes mainstream. So I think there's a lot of hype right now, a lot of things happening around it, but whether or not it becomes mainstream, I think we got a little bit of time. Then it's just a matter of, you know, coming back to, you know, what are the safeguards in place? A lot of conversations right now in safety by design, a lot of conversations about, have we vetted this? Very similar to conversations happening, you know, 10 years ago, right? Like, how do we kind of get in front of this? I think we know enough now to make that, but yeah, it's in terms of the tech, it's out there, it's happening. I think folks are using it, and to, you know, to take it away, I think we'll kind of limit folks' understanding. I don't know. I mean, how does it feel familiar to the last big tech launch to you? Like you were, I know you were around for that as well. Or do you seen, are you kind of thinking, you're like, nah, I think we should take a pause.
You're right, Matt. I am old. And I have seen, as a result of that, I have seen a few rounds of innovative technology. I think there's a sort of a misunderstanding around AI. I think people think of AI as far more human than it actually is, far more sentient. I'm not sure it's the right phrase, but that somehow it's sort of self-aware, you know, And the AI that we're talking about at the moment is not, it's not some sort of self-thinking system. I mean, compared to 20 years ago tech, yeah, sure, it's, it seems that way. But it's basically just drawing from information that we've created and put out on the internet and just, you know, analyzing that and then presenting it back to us in a smarter way. And so it's no wonder that the current AI is, you know, reflects all those negative things. And whenever you sort of set it out to self-learn, it comes back and makes racist statements or sexist statements or whatever. It's just because it's not actually, you know, self-aware. It's not able to learn those things. It's just reflecting society. So I do think there's a bit of a misunderstanding about what AI is, and that's leading to some of the backlash. But I'm really interested in the fact that people who clearly do know what it is, you know, people who are running big companies developing AI, are some of the people signing it. And I wonder if they're presenting and signing those petitions because they are concerned about AI, or they're just concerned about other people developing it, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean necessarily just in a straight business competitive way, because that's, you know, it's a possibility. But they're simply saying, look, I've seen what I can kind of do in the near future, and I'm worried that somebody else with that kind of capability might misuse it and cause mayhem. And so I am interested to understand a little bit more about what their fears are, but I don't see a value in putting the brakes on, because, you know, some people would stop developing it, but the majority of people wouldn't, you know.
Right.
Still be developing.
No, and that's where I think having, with any new tech, having some type of like ethical framework or structure in place is, you know, as a driving force. And that's been the constant battle in the tech world as long as I can remember, right? Is, you know, do we launch this new feature, or do we make sure that this feature is safe? And there's a constant give and take with that from a business development standpoint, when you're just like, we have investors we need to appease, and versus, you know, we need to do this in the right way in order to ensure that we vetted this product and it does exactly what it says it does. You know, to your point about, like, you know, is with the negative stuff coming out of AI, is like a lot of the early news stories were kind of frustrating. It's like, well, I use this AI app and I got it to do this. Like, well, of course you did. You wanted it to do that. Right. And it's that just sheer manipulation of, you know, I can make this tech do a lot of terrible things. I choose not to, because it's who I am and how it's developed. So then the safety aspect to it is then, right, what do we put in place because we know this is the right thing to do to ensure those types of things don't happen?
Julia McGrath, who's the eSafety Commissioner for Australia, she's been talking about online safety having to find its seatbelt moment. I got two questions, I guess. One is, what do you think the seatbelt moment for online safety might be? And then secondly, if online safety was a car, what sort of car would it be?
Ooh. If I said Tesla, would I start any fights?
As long as you can justify it.
Yeah, I think it depends on the platform. I wish I was more of a car person. That could be a fun debate. I feel like we're on the front end of the seatbelt moment now. With you have the Digital Services Act, you know, I'm hoping the U.S. will do some of the federal level here soon, online safety bill. There's legislation that's being drafted, has been drafted up in Singapore, Taiwan, and other areas. Brazil is getting into the regulatory game. And so I feel like we're starting to see the beginning of that. There's some time to go because, you know, more than just having the seatbelt, there's all the conversation of what does it look like? Where does it need to be placed? How is it going to be enforced? Who's going to enforce it? And how do we kind of work together to make sure that it's being done appropriately, right? And those types of systems just take a lot of time. But yeah, I think we're kind of there. We've had about 10 years, and I guess to stick with the metaphor, the joyride is kind of over. So how do we get back into sort of kind of enforcing and working together to make that happen? And I think, again, with all the regulation coming down next 5 to 10 years, I think we'll see a lot, but I really think we're on the front end of that seatbelt space. So yeah. One, what kind of car do you think it'll be? And two, do you think we're there? Has it already happened, or are we still waiting for that opportunity?
I find the seatbelt metaphor sometimes a little bit challenging because it's this idea of this kind of moment that changes everything. It feels like there's so many aspects to online safety that it feels more like the kind of general development of safety in vehicles, you know, that you would, you know, talk about, well, we've already invented the seatbelt, but, you know, we have to come up with what is our equivalent of airbags and traction control and all those sorts of things, and get way too deep into those metaphors for people who really aren't interested in cars. In terms of where we're at, I can't go past the DeLorean as the representative car for online safety because of all the mystery and confusion and the the kind of story that goes with that, and because I guess it's sort of halfway between the development of cars and where we're at today in terms of what it would have had for safety technology. But I'm not sure that was a good question, to be honest. I just throw that one out off the list.